is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 49. Got a great show for you today. We've got Mitch Steele from Stone Brewing Company going to talk about his new book on IPAs for us. Just got one announcement, which is Beersmith Lite is out. I mentioned it before for iPhone, iPad, Android tablet. It's a companion app. It's a light app that lets you basically do a brew day timer, run a number of tools, search the Beersmith recipe cloud, transfer recipes from your desktop to run that brew day timer. And we're working on a full version, which will be out in a few months. And now, without any further ado, let's jump right into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Mitch Steele. He's the author of the new book, IPA, Brewing Techniques, Recipes, and the Evolution of India Pale Ale. Mitch is also the Stone Brewing Company brewmaster, has a degree in fermentation from the fermentation science from the University of California, Davis. He's also an avid home brewer. Mitch, it's fantastic to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
So congratulations on your new book. It's, I think you've created the definitive book on IPAs. And so let's start with that. Let's start with a little bit of the history of IPAs, which you spend a fair amount of time in the book.
Yeah, you know, originally the intent for this book was to be one of the Brewing Styles series. And as I started researching India Pale Ale, and I was over in England and I met a few people that had some really good information on the history and how it was brewed in the 1800s. I realized that there was a lot more to the story that really hadn't been widely publicized yet. There were people that had put it out there, but it hadn't really made its way to, you know, at least to the United States. And I talked with Christy Switzer, who's the publisher or the editor at Brewers Publications. And I told her, I said, you know, this could be a really, really comprehensive book if we want it to be, and have a lot of really interesting historical facts about how IPA started and how it was brewed, and she was agreeable to doing that. So I got totally sucked into the history part of this,
I think you devoted right at least a third of the book to history, right?
Yeah. And you know, I'm not really a history buff, but my gosh, this just grabbed me and wouldn't let go.
Well, I love history. So, can you talk a little bit about it? How did IPAs come about?
Well, it appears there's the myth out there, or the story that we're all familiar with. You know, that the IPA was invented by George Hodgson, who had a brewery in London and worked with the East India Company and invented this beer to make the trip to India. And it doesn't appear that was actually the case. It seems more realistic to come to the conclusion that he was brewing a pale ale and he started shipping it to India alongside his porter, and the pale ale really took off as the beer that was the popular beer. And you know, all the way from the time he started shipping beer, which most people think was in the middle to late 1700s, to the time when Burton the Burton brewers got involved in the 1820s, he was shipping pale ale alongside with porter to India on the East India Company ships, and really never said it was anything special, anything that he had invented, anything that he brewed specifically for this trip. It just, you know, if you look at the advertisements and advertisements primarily in price lists, it was listed as pale ale, and it was put alongside with his porter.
So is it, how did it end up so hoppy though?
Well, you know, it looks like, number one, I think a lot of beers in England were hopped at that kind of level at that time, especially beers that were brewed to be aged. There was a standard that the English brewers would hop beers that were to be aged, keeping beers or stock beers, at a higher level than the fresh beers. And the pale ale was definitely a stock beer at that time. It was one that was aged. And the other piece is that the brewers that were putting the beers on boats always put hops in the barrels to help preserve them. That was a practice long before India Pale Ale. And so it was kind of a standard procedure just to brew the beer with extra hops anyway.
And how did some of the, you know, how did the development of IPA happen over the years? Obviously, you know, you said it started in the 1700s. It evolved considerably to what we have as a modern IPA, right?
It has. And really, you know, looking at the history of IPA, I think there are four distinct versions of the beer. And the first one was the Hodgson's beer. And then in 1820, the East India Company got kind of tired of dealing with Hodgson. And it's all detailed out in the book. And if you read Pete Brown's book, Hops and Glory, there's a lot more detail about the East India Company and kind of what was going on there. But basically, Hodgson was a price gouger and really kind of took advantage of the situation. And so the East India Company approached the Allsop Brewery in Burton about brewing a version of this beer to send to India. And that's really where, in my mind, the IPA became the IPA, because the Burton brewers developed some specific techniques to brew the beer, and it really took off into the beer that we kind of consider what IPA is today. We don't know a whole lot about Hodgson's beer, but we do know a lot about the Burton beers. And you know, when the Burton brewers started getting involved, and you're looking at Salt and Allsop and Bass, by about they started brewing this beer in the early 1820s, and by about 1835 they had knocked Hodgson off the top post as far as IPA brewing. And they dominated the market from that point on. And they developed some very specific techniques to brew this beer. A couple of things that struck me as really interesting is, number one, they had developed a very pale malt. And pale malt was actually developed in the late 1600s when maltsters started using coke as a fuel instead of wood or straw or peat or whatever.
Right. I would assume... Before that, probably had a pretty strong wood smoky flavor, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I get out of the research is that there was a lot of smoke, and that was one of the reasons why the beers were aged for so long, was to kind of temper that smoky character. But you know, once pale malt was developed, the Burton brewers developed their own method for kilning the pale malt at a very low temperature, so they ended up with a very pale malt. And then from that point on, every brewing procedure that was used in Burton was designed to make this beer as light in color as possible. So they took it to an extreme. They used 150 degree kilning temperature, and we're talking degrees Fahrenheit here, but it was significantly lower than what normal pale malt was kilned at, which was somewhere around 180, 190.
Probably something closer to a Pilsner malt, right?
Yep, exactly.
A modern Pilsner malt.
Yep, and it was called white malt or extra pale malt, and you can still get this malt in England. There's some English maltsters are still making it, but it's hard to find in the United States. So that was one. And then the Burton brewers undersized their wort kettles, and you know, a lot of colors developed during the kettle boil. You get the Maillard reactions and things like that, you know, where you're developing some rich golden amber type hues in the boil. Well, they undersized their kettles so that the boils were, and the boil time was very long, and the boil intensity was very low, so the color development in the boil was minimal. And the whole idea here was to get a beer that was extremely light in color, and that was one thing that I thought was pretty interesting about how they approached the brewing of the beer. Now, Hodgson, nobody really knows whether he did that or not, but indications are that the Burton beer was paler in color than the Hodgson beer. And then the other big piece that I thought from the Burton perspective was the aging period. You know, this was the time before artificial refrigeration was available. And what the way they approached the brewing is they would always use, the freshest ingredients in their IPA. They would brew the IPA in October, November, December timeframe. They would have fresh malt from the maltsters that year's crop. They'd use the freshest hops they could get from the hop growers in England. So they didn't store these hops at all, and they would reserve the best of these ingredients for India Pale Ale. They'd brew the beer in the fall and early winter. They'd let it undergo a primary fermentation, and then after that primary fermentation had stopped, they'd put the beer in a barrel and hold it for another 12 months or so. During the summertime, when the temperatures warmed up again, they debung the barrels and allow that yeast culture to restart and then finish out the fermentation. So by the time the beer was done fermenting, you know, in August, September, that's about the time they started thinking about shipping the beer to India. So it had already undergone two fermentations, was incredibly dry beer. And the part of the reason for that was that if it had any fermentable extract left in it, the barrels would explode on the boat trip, you know, as they warmed up and as fermentation could get going again. So, you know, they didn't want to have this wild fermentation going in the barrels on the boat trip.
I mean, that's almost a whole year, though, before they would even consider shipping it, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So that's totally different than what we do today, where we talk about a fresh IPA and getting that fresh American hop character in an IPA. That wasn't the objective with the Burton IPA. It was to develop a more refined, elegant character and let the hops kind of go back into the flavor a little bit of the beer. And so I think the beer profile was much different than what we consider an IPA profile today. It was still really hoppy, I think. And this is kind of based on some trials we've done with the old recipes and some beers I've tasted from home brewers in England who have brewed these beers and have let them age for a year or so. And they're really hoppy beers, but not at the same level and not at the same intensity.
I would imagine you probably lose a lot of those fresh aromas, right?
Yeah. You know, so, and the Golding's hops tend to age pretty well. You know, it's not like, and this is something I'd like to explore a little bit myself, but you know, how American hop character fades over time versus hops from other regions, you know, and whether there's any difference there, but it sure seems like American hops tend to fade a lot more than the Golding's character.
Yeah. Golding's is one of my favorite. Well, what are some of the modern IPA categories and variations?
Well, of course you've got, the American IPA, which is the one that, you know, I think most people associate with IPA now, you know, the American, version brewed with, pale malt, maybe a little bit of specialty malt, heavily hopped with American varieties. Back when I started, Cascade was pretty much the variety that was used in IPA. But over time, as new hop varieties came out, there were the Centennial, Chinook, Columbus. You know, you had the Four Seas. You know, from the early 90s up until about the late 90s, and now. I think what's happened is as growers are developing new varieties, new hop varieties, IPAs are becoming this wide spectrum of hop flavors, very interesting, different types of characteristics, you know. So that's to me is the primary example of the IPA. English IPA, of course, there are some breweries in England that are recreating these old recipes. The best example I can think of is Meantime. They're brewing a seven plus percent. And they're definitely historians, and I talked with them a lot in the work on this book, and they get the IPA history, and their Meantime IPA was brewed to be similar to the beers that were brewed in Burton in the 1800s, and then of course Goose Island wins a medal every year, it seems like, at the Great American Beer Festival for their IPA in the English IPA category. And then, of course, you've got the offshoots. You've got the double IPA, you've got the black IPA, you've got the Belgian IPA, and now there are people brewing white IPA, which is kind of a cross between a Belgian wit and an IPA. So, you know, there'll be more, too, you know.
where's an Imperial IPA fall in there?
To me, Imperial IPA is the same thing as a double IPA. It's same beer. And then you've got people brewing triple IPAs, which I'm not sure exactly where that falls in as far as, I've heard different things as far as where that falls in alcohol content and hopping profile and things like that. But, there's a lot coming and there's probably going to be more as time goes on.
Well, let's try and focus down on maybe one or two. Maybe talk a little bit about American or English IPA and how you might actually go about brewing it.
Okay.
Where do you start with, say, the grain bill? Let's start with the grain bill.
Well, if you're going to brew an IPA, I think the big thing here is to use a really large proportion of pale malt and really minimize the specialty malts in an IPA. And that accomplishes a couple of things. Number one, and probably most importantly, it allows the fresh hop character to really come through. And especially as the beer gets some age on it and as the hops tend to fade, if you have a lot of crystal malts in your IPA recipe, those crystal malts tend to turn into dried fruit, raisin, prune type characters over time, and they're going to mask the hops even quicker than if you hadn't used the crystal malts at all. Mm. Now, you know, there's a lot of people that think you need to use a fair amount of crystal malts to balance out the bitterness, and I get that, but I don't necessarily agree with it. You know, there are people that as the alcohol goes up, brewers, as the alcohol goes up, they will increase the specialty malt to try and balance things out. And I think that's, I don't agree with that approach because I think the alcohol adds body on its own.
Yeah.
And you really don't need it. Now, the question of balance of malt and hops is highly subjective, of course, you know, yeah. And there are people that want nothing but a hop bomb and they don't want any malt at all. And then there are people that want a really balanced beer. And they eat, you know, and I think they're great beers made both ways. I tend to prefer a little bit less on the specialty malt side, using very light colored crystal malts in an IPA, maybe 5% mm-hmm. of the total grain bill, and call it good. Another way to do it, and a way that I like a lot, is using some Munich malt and just adding a little bit of malt complexity. Some people will use pale malt and English pale malt kind of blended together to give you a little more malt complexity as well.
That's what I was wondering. What do you use for a base malt? Are you looking for like a neutral base malt, or are you looking for something flavorful like a Maris Otter?
I think it depends. It depends on what you want to do. And I think, you know, both ways work really well. You know, I think it's, you know, I love using English malt in an IPA, whether it's an English IPA or an American IPA. It just gives a nice malt character to the beer, you know, a little bit more complexity than, say, like using a Pilsner malt.
Okay, so you're basically 90-95% pale malt,
right?
And say 5% crystal or maybe Munich malt. Any other ingredients you would use on the grain bill side?
You know, for me, that's where I'd start. I mean, you could add some things like, you know, maybe like a victory malt or some other kind of roasted malt in there. It depends on what you want. You know, there are brewers that use dextrose in the formulation.
Which gives body, right?
No, dextrose actually is pure sugar. So it lightens the body and gives you a little more alcohol. Dextrin malt is used sometimes to add body, you know, or carapils or, yeah. So, you know, and there's some good IPAs brewing with that. When I was first started brewing IPAs, I used to use dextrin malt. I don't so much anymore. We don't use it at Stone, so we haven't really gone back to using it at all. You know, but it works. It's some of the best IPAs in the world are brewed using some dextrin malt just to give it that little extra body.
So pretty simple grain bill. Let's move on to hops, which obviously play a critical role here. What are some of your favorite hop varieties, and then how high do you go? I mean, I've seen people in the hundreds of IBUs, you know.
Yeah, I think the higher alcohol, you know, you can step up your hops incrementally with your alcohol target, you know. Although, you know, and that being said, we got the opportunity to brew a collaboration beer with a local home brewer, and it was a 4.2% alcohol beer.
Wow.
And we hopped the beer like a double IPA. We didn't quite go for the bittering on that, but you know, on as far as the back end, the flavor hops and the boil, we hop in the Whirlpool here at Stone, and then the dry hop, it was double IPA all the way. And wow. Boy, that beer was phenomenal. We called it San Diego County Session Ale, and it was just a wonderful, just amazing hop character that lasted forever. And that was the thing that was really cool about it, is we thought this beer would have a 90-day shelf life, and I tell you what, it's six months. It tasted great. So you can approach hopping a lot of different ways. There are people that like to hop in the mash and hop first wort, and I'm not sure what that really does. It's fun to do, and I like doing it, but we haven't really put some studies to it to actually see what you get out of it, which is something that's on my list that I'd like to actually explore.
Well, let's start at the beginning, though. Let's start with hop varieties. What are your favorite hop varieties to use?
Well, my favorite hop varieties, obviously at Stone, we use a lot of Centennial hop, and I absolutely love it. You know, to me, when we have a nice, fresh Centennial character in our beer, it comes across as a lemon drop candy or lemon rind. Absolutely love that flavor. Cascade hop is a classic. You can't go wrong with Cascade. You get that nice grapefruit and pine character out of the Cascade. Chinook, I tend not to use for dry hopping, although I've had some wonderful beers made with Chinook in the dry hop. And, you know, Chinook can get kind of dank at times and can get, you know, you get more of that resiny and sometimes a little bit of harshness. But when it's spot on, you get this beautiful apricot flavor and citrus kind of combined. And that to me is the essence of a really nice Chinook hop. Columbus, you got to be careful with Columbus because, you know, I know legally Columbus Tomahawk and Zeus are all the same hop, but I swear I can tell differences between them. Especially with Zeus. And so if you're buying CTZs, you might get Zeus and not Columbus. And I, you know, legally and genetically, they might be the same hop and there may be growing conditions that create some differences, but I've always preferred Columbus, to the other two varieties that are lumped into that same category. And I like Columbus. I like Columbus as a blending hop, not something to use 100% in a dry hop, for example, maybe as a late flavor hop with some other varieties. Newer hops, Amarillo, of course, is a favorite of a lot of people. Our brewhouse supervisor loves Simcoe. The piney resin caddy character of Simcoe is his favorite. Me, with Amarillo and Simcoe, we like to blend them together, and that's my preference. I think either one on its own is it can be a bit much, although I've had 100% Amarillo and Simcoe hops that are wonderful, but I love to blend them, you know, and we blend them in our Sublimely Self-Righteous, our black IPA, at a 50% each in the dry hop. Let's see, what other hops are awesome out there? God, the New Zealand hops are great. Nelson Sauvin, Motueka. We did a beer recently with we took our IPA and then dry hopped it instead of with Centennial, a blend of Centennial and Motueka, and it tasted like Fruit Loops cereal. It was just unbelievable. and then the Nelson, you get that dank berry wine like character.
What if you wanted to go with the classic English hops? What would you recommend?
You got to go Goldings.
I'm a big fan of Goldings. So
yeah, now there's some really nice ones out there that they kind of replicate that Goldings character. Summer, I think was the name. No, that's not it. I'm trying to think of the name of the hop and I'm coming up blank right now. Sovereign, you've got the Challengers and things like that. We've used Target. We did an English IPA for our 14th anniversary. And we did a blend of Goldings and Target adds this really nice tangerine character, plus that intense English earthiness. And used in moderation, I think Target is a beautiful hop as well.
Okay, so let's break down the second question, which is IBU levels. Where do you go? What's the balance between how much hops and how much malt? So bitterness to gravity, for example.
That's a good question. I've had Great American IPAs that are brewed anywhere from 45 to 80 IBUs. Our Stone IPA comes in just over 70 IBUs. I tend to think 60 to 70 is a good place to be with something that's going to be, 6 to 7% alcohol. Mm-hmm. Once you start getting up to 8%, 9%, and into that double IPA category, then you start shooting for, 90 to 100. But there's research out there that shows that you don't perceive bitterness past 80 IBUs. So once you get past 80, it's irrelevant. But you get other stuff besides, perceived bitterness. You get the flavor, you get the intensity, and it's not just bitter. It's about everything else that you're getting from the hops as well. So, for me, American IPA, I would target probably 65 to start with and then go from there.
Sounds like a reasonable range. And then the final question, of course, is when do you add the hops? There's obviously, as you point out, a whole bunch of ways to add it.
Yeah. It's Stone what we've done. And we typically do one kettle addition, and then we have a separate whirlpool here. So we dump a lot of hops in the whirlpool for flavor. And we actually get some bitterness out of those hops, a fair amount. We haven't actually gotten a utilization number yet. We're working on that right now, trying to understand what we get out of the whirlpool hops. And that's how we hop here traditionally. We've done some beers where we've started adding flavor additions towards the end of the boil, just to get a little more hop complexity. And I think you do get that from that practice. Mm-hmm. You can cover that up if you're dry hopping really heavily. You might lose that. And then the last beer that we did, the Enjoy by IPA, we took a little different approach. We kind of looked at it like we did with that San Diego Session beer and hopped it pretty lightly on the bittering side. and then really, really dosed it up on the flavor hops. And we get about 50% of our bitterness from the flavor hop addition. And that's a wonderful way to go. I'm starting to like that a lot. So, you know, it obviously it depends on what you're trying to achieve. I think the jury's still out, but, you know, the traditional three hop addition, you know, in a homebrew scheme is a great place to start. And then you can kind of balance things, you know, with your bittering hop, your flavor, your aroma hop additions as you like. And then to me, the most important part of an IPA hopping schedule is the dry hop. And, you know, as far as addition rates and timing and things like that, there's a lot of different ways to go, but we're kind of in that, you know, 3/4 of a pound to a pound per barrel rate, which is pretty high. I know when I first started brewing IPAs, we were looking at, you know, 1/3 of a pound to a 1/2 pound per barrel. And when I got to Stone, that all changed. But we tend to go a lot heavier than that. And I think that's
so,
a good way
so
to go.
So let's talk about dry hopping for a minute. What, do you have any advice for folks that are trying to dry hop at home? When do you do it? When what comes out best?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there's a lot of different approaches people take. I think a couple of important things that we've learned. Number one, you got to let the fermentation finish out. The yeast are going to absorb a lot of the hop character, a lot of the hop oils and things like that, the yeast cell walls. So you know, make sure your primary fermentation is complete. If you can rack the beer off of the yeast, get the beer off most of the yeast before you do the dry hop, you're going to get more intensity. The other thing is the temperature of the dry hop. I tend to like dry hopping at a temperature a little bit colder than the primary fermentation temperature, but not cold. I don't like to dry hop chilled beer because I think you don't extract as much flavor out of the hops when it's at 34 degrees, for example. What we do here is we chill the beer down from our fermentation temperature of 72 to 62, get most of the yeast to drop out, remove the yeast from the fermenter, and that's when we dry hop.
How long do you dry hop?
Well, we do 3 circulations over 36 hours. We chill the beer down. It takes 2 to 3 days for the beer to chill down to 34 degrees. But we're looking for 7 days of total contact time with the dry hops. And I don't like to go a whole lot more than that, because I think you start getting more of that vegetal character, or what I call a stemmy character, out of the hops.
Grassy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's been, I was at the World Brewing Congress put on by the Master Brewers and the American Society of Brewing Chemists this summer. And there was a presentation given where the dry hopping, most of the flavor is extracted in the first 2 or 3 days, provided you get good mixing of the hops and good saturation of the hops in the beer. And I thought that was really interesting, because most people are going, you know, at least 7 days. Some people are going 2 weeks with the dry hop residence time. And there was a presentation where somebody was actually continuously circulating the hops in the beer for 12 hours and then calling it good. And then they'd remove the hops and they were getting a really good hop character out of that. So a lot of different ways to approach it. But I think the big thing is you want the beer to be somewhat warm, and you don't want to let the beer sit on the hops for too long.
Right. What about mashing profiles? What's your preferred?
Mashing profiles. I like to go dry with an IPA, which means low temperature, long time for conversion rest. You know, anywhere from, you know, if you're doing a double IPA, I like to be down in the high 140s, 148, 149. Right. That's actually the temperature that when I was with Anheuser-Busch that we used to use for Bud Light to get it really dry.
Yeah.
We used to do a 148, 147, 148 mash temperature for 5 hours with Bud Light. Now, wow. I'm not saying that's what you want to do with a double IPA, but you know, 148 for an hour and a half or so, that's great. For standard IPA, maybe a little warmer, getting a little more body in the beer, 150 to 154, somewhere in that range. Once you start getting above that, if you start going less than an hour conversion time, you're going to get too much residual sweetness in the beer, and it's going to be, you're going to have trouble getting that hop balance that you want, or that hop intensity.
Yeah, you want it dry.
Yeah.
What role does water play? You know, you mentioned Burton. So how does water play in here?
Yeah, you know, it's obviously the one of the main reasons for the success of the Burton beers is they traveled well, and a big part of that is the water, very high in the calcium content, the sulfate content, and what the Yeah. And what the calcium, you know, does, those all kind of enhance the hop bitterness. You know, you get this really, at high levels, you get a really clean bitter character instead of a harsh bitter character. And then the other thing is that it also helps the yeast settle out, which was really important. You wanted to get a nice clear beer. And I remember talking to some Burton brewmasters, and they know exactly the water profile of all the wells in Burton. And it's huge. It's a huge ingredient for them. In the United States, we don't pay that much attention to it. And honestly, you know, we use pretty soft water here at Stone, and we've been using that to brew our IPA forever. And I think our IPA is pretty good. We just started adding some calcium back into the mash at Stone and to the boil to kind of enhance the true development and the hop bitterness and the hop extraction. So water is important. I wouldn't, personally, I don't spend a tremendous amount of time on the water profile, you know, just to kind of make sure it's within a certain range. But I think you can brew a really good IPA with today's technology with soft water. You got to remember that back in the Burton days, they didn't have refrigeration, and they didn't have, you know, fining agents, and they didn't have filtration and things like that that kind of help you get past any sort of water variables that you might be encountering. But definitely hard water is a good thing to use for an IPA, one with a lot of carbonate and calcium and sulfate in it. If you get too much sulfate, you tend to get a lot of sulfur in the beer, which isn't a good thing. You know, they call it the Burton snatch in Burton, that bite of sulfur that hits you right on your nose when you smell the beer. I don't particularly like that in an IPA. I tend to prefer a cleaner character. And of course, yeast selection is important with that as well.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about next. What's your preferred yeast to use?
Our house yeast here at Stone is a proprietary.
Right. Yeast, but I'm saying out of the homebrewing yeast, what would you prefer?
You know, the classic California ale yeast is a great one.
Nice and dry finish.
Yeah. Nice and dry finish. I apologize in advance. I'm not really well versed with the numbers, the yeast numbers,
okay.
But the Fuller's ale yeast, whichever one that is a great yeast to use. And then of course, you know, if you can get you know, like a Burton yeast, those are good as well. You know, I tend to like yeast that attenuate well, don't produce a lot of sulfur, don't produce a lot of fermentation compounds, esters or diacetyl. You know, things that really produce a clean fermentation are the ones that I prefer.
So, I mean, that would probably be the California ale yeast, which is really, really pretty clean.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with that one. That's a great one to use for any IPA. And a lot of the IPAs that win awards are fermented with that yeast.
Well, do you use any special techniques when brewing, fermenting, or finishing an IPA?
Our procedure is pretty standard. You know, it's we're using an infusion mash. We raise to a mash off temperature to stop the conversion. We boil for 90 minutes as a standard. Like I said, we do use a lot of whirlpool hopping. We dump a lot of hops into the whirlpool before we transfer the wort over from the kettle.
So, I mean, a homebrewer could probably use a hop back to get something similar, right?
Exactly. We're using all pellets here. So, you know, and so, you know, my experience with whole hops goes back to Anheuser-Busch. But I do like, I remember doing some trials with whole hops versus pellets in the mid-90s and really liking the whole hops. And I think that's variety dependent. And now with the technology that's been put into pelletizing hops, I'm not sure how important that is.
Yeah, and the storage is much better than it was even a few years ago, too. So
exactly. Exactly. One thing that I do like that we don't do a whole lot of here at Stone, but is doing multiple dry hops. And, you know, dry hopping once, getting those hops off, and then hitting it again with another dose of dry hops, either as the beer is stored cold or as it's still chilling. And you just get that extra bump from that and an extra level of complexity and hop intensity that I think is really nice. And some of the best double IPAs are done using that technique. And we do. You know, sometimes we'll take our Stone IPA and we'll put it into a tank and then add more hops to it. And we release it in small batches and kegs only, you know, and that's, you know, when I was talking about the Centennial Motueka blend, that's what we did there. And it was a lot of fun. I think that's a really great technique for really enhancing the hop aromatics and the hop flavor.
Well, let's talk for just a minute about some of the variations, like an Imperial IPA. What would you change to make a good Imperial or double IPA?
Yep. First thing I would do, starting with the malt bill, is I would pull out any specialty malts at all.
Just pale malt.
Maybe even using dextrose or some sugars to try and accentuate the dryness. Remember, you're going to have a higher alcohol content here. You're going to get a lot of perceived body from that alcohol. So you don't necessarily need to get body from your grain. You want to make it as light in color as possible, again, to enhance the hop character. One technique that some really good double IPA brewers use is to use a blend of pale malt and English pale malt. Or even using Pilsner malt and English pale malt in a blend. And then dextrose sugars are real common as well. So that's the malt piece. Mashing, again, go with very low temperatures, long conversion rest. So 148 for 2 hours is pretty reasonable for a double IPA. Mm-hmm. Again, you're going to get that terminal gravity down in the 2 to 2.5 range. Really dry beer allows the hops to really shine through. Let's see, what else can we talk about?
You mentioned you hop it a little bit higher, right?
Yeah. You know, the tradition was double the hops. And that's certainly a good place to start, doubling the hops from a regular IPA recipe. Maybe not so much on the bittering side, but definitely on the flavoring side. Remember, the alcohol that you produce in the fermentation is going to have kind of a solvent effect. You're going to get a lot more hop character out of there. So you can use more hops and get more character, more flavor out of those hops. Especially in the dry hop piece, you know, double that dry hop rate, go up, a pound and a half per barrel, 2 pounds per barrel, you're going to end up with a fantastic double IPA.
And what about brewing a dark IPA? What would that variation look like?
Yeah. You know, what I would do with a dark IPA is kind of use that double IPA grain bill, you know, use all pale malt and then add some dehusked black malt. And what's nice about that, you know, like the Carafa malt from Wireman, and there's some other ones out there now, is that without that husk, you don't get the dark malt astringency, you know, that you'd get in a porter or a stout that you use black malt or chocolate malt in, or roast barley or something like that, you know, where you get that kind of burnt astringency on the end, which is an important part of the flavor profile of a stout or a porter. But it can kind of, conflict with the hop character in an IPA type beer. So what I like to use is Carafa at about 5% of the grain bill. And that gives you a nice black color. And it gives you a little bit of roast character, adds some flavor complexity to the beer, but really allows the hops to shine through, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want chocolate malt or some of those other darker malts that are going to give you harshness, right?
I mean, I know that some of the the brewers up in Oregon that are brewing the Cascadian dark ales are using black malts and chocolate malts. And to me, that's a little different than a black IPA, for example. That's more, kind of in between a porter and an IPA. You know, it's like a really hoppy porter or a really hoppy stout. It's got more of that roast character. But to me, a black IPA should drink like an IPA and just have that nice dark color and that hint of roast character. And that, to me, that's what works in a black IPA.
Well, I wanted to just take a minute at the end to give you a chance to talk about your new book. Just came out. I've got two copies here, actually. I've been enjoying reading through it. Can you talk for a minute about your new book from Brewers Publications?
Yeah, it was a great experience. It took me 3 years to put this together. Brewers Publications approached Steve Wagner and myself about potentially doing the book, and Steve was my research partner, and Steve is our co-founder here at Stone Brewing Company, and he's my boss. He's been the brewmaster at Stone for a long period of time. And, since day one. And so Steve and I took the trips to England and did a lot of the research on this. And the research part of the book was just sucked me in. It was fascinating. You know, I met some people in England who have done a lot of research on historical IPA, and they really set me down this path. Originally, the book wasn't supposed to be so much on the history, but it was just so intriguing to me that when I was talking with Christy at Brewers Publications about the book, I said, you know, we can do a lot with this history stuff here. There's some really great information. So, you know, putting together the history of the IPA and digging through old brewing logs and looking at old brewing recipes and looking at advertisements for IPA from Burton and from Hodgson was really a fascinating part of the the process of writing the book. And then a couple of really interesting things that I found out, you know, aside from the Burton stuff, which we already talked about, is that there was back in the 1800s on the East Coast of the United States, there were a ton of IPAs being brewed, and some of them were even shipped to India. But, you know, there were a lot of breweries that were making IPAs that were aging them for a year in wood tanks and letting them really mellow out before they released them, get really clear beer. C.H. Evans in Albany, New York, Feigenspan in on the East Coast, and Ballantine, of course, which is the one that survived Prohibition and actually was brewed up until the 1960s in its original form, and inspired not only Fritz Maytag but also Ken Grossman to brew their groundbreaking, you know, Liberty Ale and Sierra Nevada Celebration Ale. So, you know, it's a lot of inspiration came from a lot of different places with IPA brewing. And Scotland, you can't not talk about Scotland when you talk about IPA brewing, and that's something that hardly anybody really realizes. But Edinburgh was a huge IPA brewing center, and the Younger Brewery in particular brewed a ton of IPA that was shipped to India. And there's a lot of really good technical information on those beers. There's the Scottish Brewer book, and I can't remember the exact title of the book. It's got a spreadsheet basically from the 1840s that lists characteristics of several dozen IPAs that were brewed in Scotland, you know, analytical targets, alcohols, terminal gravities, original gravities, those kind of things. And that's where you understand how dry these beers were, how much alcohol was in them, and what they were really like.
Well, Mitch, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, it's a wonderful beer style. I think, I remember somebody saying that IPA was going to be the next American lager, and I don't know if it'll ever reach that height of popularity, but it sure is fun right now to brew them. I love brewing them, and I know a lot of people do. So, you know, I thank everybody who's bought the book. I hope people enjoy it. And you know, all the brewers that contributed recipes, I really appreciate their help. I got a lot of really great recipes from some of the best brewers in the country, and was really excited to be able to share those with everybody.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you being on the show, Mitch.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, my guest was Mitch Steele. He's the author of the new book, IPA Brewing Techniques, Recipes, and the Evolution of India Pale Ale. Mitch is also the Stone Brewing Company brewmaster, and he joins us from California. Well, a big thank you to Mitch Steele for appearing on the show. A reminder to you, if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, you can go to beersmith.com, click on the newsletter link, and we'll send you an article on homebrewing every single week. Also, if you have feedback for the show, you can go to our discussion forum at beersmith.com/forum and leave a message there. Or you can go to this episode at beersmith.com/blog, where you can actually find all 49 episodes of the Beersmith podcast if you want to catch those. And we also have them on video now. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.